As to the second trap, tunnel vision, many scientists simply do not look at evidence of the reality of God. They wear a self-imposed set of blinders, which prevents them from turning their attention to the Spirit. Among the causes of this tunnel vision are two that derive from scientific tradition. The first is an issue of methodology. In its laudable insistence upon accurate observation and verifiability, science has placed great emphasis upon measurement. To measure something is to experience it in a certain dimension, a dimension in which observations of great accuracy can be made and repeated by others. Measurement has enabled science to make enormous strides in understanding the material universe. But by virtue of its success, measurement has become a scientific idol. Many scientists reject outright what cannot be measured. They say, what we cannot measure, we cannot know. Therefore, what cannot be measured is unworthy of observation. Many scientists, therefore, exclude from serious consideration all matters that are, or seem to be, intangible, including God. This strange assumption that things which are not easy to study do not merit study is being challenged by recent changes in science itself. One is the development of increasingly sophisticated methods of study. Through the use of electron microscopes, spectrophotometers, computers, and subtle statistical techniques, we are now able to measure complex phenomena which a few decades ago were unmeasurable. The range of scientific vision is expanding. Another development that is helping science escape from tunnel vision is the discovery by science of the reality of paradox. 100 years ago, paradox meant error to the scientific mind. But now it is widely recognized that at a certain level, reality is paradoxical. J. Robert Oppenheimer wrote, "If we ask whether the position of the electron remains the same, we must say no. If we ask whether the electron's position changes with time, we must say no. If we ask whether it is in motion, we must say no." The Buddha has given such answers when interrogated as to the conditions of a man's self after his death. Mystics through the ages have spoken in paradox. Are we beginning to see a meeting between science and religion? When we are able to say that a human is both mortal and eternal at the same time, and that light is both a wave and a particle at the same time, we have begun to speak the same language. Does the path of spiritual growth, which proceeds from religious superstition to scientific skepticism, lead ultimately to religious reality? This possibility of unifying religion and science is the most significant happening in our intellectual life today. But for the most part, religion and science remain blinded by tunnel vision. Examine, for instance, the behavior of both in regard to miracles. Even the idea of a miracle is an anathema to most scientists. In their worldview, scientists have made an idol out of natural law, just as they have made an idol out of measurement. As a result, any event that cannot be explained by natural law as currently understood is assumed to be unreal. In regard to natural law, science tends to say, what is very difficult to understand doesn't exist. The church has been a bit more broad-minded. To the religious establishment, what cannot be understood in terms of known natural law is called a miracle. But the church has not looked at miracles closely. Miracles need not be scientifically examined, has been the prevailing religious attitude. They should simply be accepted as acts of God. The religious have not wanted religion shaken by science, just as the scientific have not wanted science shaken by religion. Churches have never said to physicians, Would you join with us to study these phenomena? Nor have physicians said, may we get together to examine scientifically these occurrences? Instead, the medical profession has insisted that miracle cures are non-existent, that the disease was either an imaginary disorder or a misdiagnosis. However, a few serious scientists and religious truth seekers are currently examining spontaneous cancer remissions and apparently successful psychic healing. When I graduated from medical school, I was certain there were no miracles. Today, I am certain that miracles abound. One reason for the change is that my work with patients has been remarkably assisted in ways for which I had no logical explanation, that is, in ways that were miraculous. These experiences led me to question my assumption that miraculous occurrences were impossible. This openness to the miraculous allowed me to look at ordinary existence with an eye for the miraculous. The more I looked, the more I found. Of this capacity, it has recently been written, "The true wonder of the world is available everywhere, in the minutest parts of our bodies, in the vast expanses of the cosmos, and in the intimate interconnectedness of these and all things. We are individuals, but we are also united in something vast and beautiful beyond description." In thinking about miracles, we have been looking for the burning bush, the parting of the sea, the bellowing voice from heaven. Instead, we should be looking at the ordinary for evidence of the miraculous, maintaining at the same time a scientific orientation. But this interface between science and religion can be shaky ground. In dealing with extrasensory perception and paranormal phenomena, we must keep our wits about us. If a healer lays hands on an inflamed joint, and the next day the joint is no longer inflamed, does this mean that the patient has been healed by the healer? The fact that two events occur together in time does not necessarily mean that one causes the other. Because the field of psychic phenomena attracts people who do poor reality testing, realistic observers are tempted to conclude that psychic phenomena themselves are unreal. Such is not the case, but we must not let our critical faculties be blinded by the brilliant beauty of the spiritual realm. In opening myself to evidence of the miraculous, I became aware of the phenomenon called grace. The word associated with grace in a famous evangelical hymn is amazing. Something amazes us when it is not predictable by natural law. It never ceases to amaze me and many other psychiatrists that our patients are so healthy mentally. A 35-year-old businessman, remarkably successful, came to see me because of a mild neurosis. He was born illegitimate and raised by a deaf and dumb mother in the slums of Chicago. When he was 5, the state took him away from her without warning and placed him in 3 successive foster homes, where he was treated with a total absence of affection. At 15, he became partially paralyzed by the rupture of a brain aneurysm. At 17, he was jailed for a vicious assault. In prison, he received no psychiatric treatment. Upon his release, the authorities got him a job as a stock clerk. No psychiatrist would have foreseen his future as anything but grim. Yet, within 3 years, he had become the youngest department head in the history of the company. In 5 years, after marrying another executive, he set up his own business and became a wealthy man, as well as a loving and effective father, a self-educated intellectual, a community leader, and an accomplished artist. How did all this come about? I do not know. Together, we determined the origins of his mild neurosis and healed him. We were unable to determine the origins of his successes. There is a force we do not fully understand that fosters mental health, even under the most adverse conditions. In this respect, the processes involved in mental disorders correspond to the processes of physical disorders. If I were to culture meningococcus from the throats of my village neighbors, I would discover it living at some point in 9 out of 10 people. Yet no one in my little village has suffered from meningococcal meningitis for many years. The disease is relatively rare, yet the causative agent is extremely common. Physicians use the concept of resistance to explain this phenomenon, and we know a good deal about how these defenses operate. But enormous questions remain. While some people who will die from meningococcal meningitis this winter will have a defective resistance, most will be healthy individuals with no known defects in their resistance systems. Meningococcus will cause their death, but on a deeper level, we will not know why they died. Somehow, the forces that normally protect our lives will have failed to operate. Many thinkers suggest that almost all disorders are psychosomatic, that the psyche is somehow involved in failures of the resistance system. But the amazing thing is that the system works as well as it does. Most of us don't sicken very often and don't die very quickly. The matter of accidents raises further interesting questions. To understand accidents, I think we need to think in terms of accident resistance as well as accident proneness. Certain people at certain times are accident prone, but in the ordinary course of things, most of us are accident resistant. Accidents involve interactions. Did the wheels of a car fail to run over me because of my survival instinct, or because the driver possessed an instinctual resistance to killing me? Perhaps we have an instinct to preserve the lives of others as well as our own. Yet instinct can hardly explain automobile accidents in which victims have crawled virtually intact out of vehicles smashed beyond recognition. You may choose to assign such incidents to pure chance, but I choose to explore further. For a start, it may be helpful to examine that part of the human mind we call the unconscious. Draw a large circle. Then at the circumference, draw a small niche in the circle. The niche represents your conscious mind. All the rest of the circle, 95% or more, represents your unconscious, a vast region that contains riches beyond imagination. One way we know of this hidden realm is through our dreams. It is because they are regularly helpful that psychotherapists pursue the analysis of dreams. When we succeed in making a translation, the message always seems designed to nurture our spiritual growth. This assistance comes as warnings of pitfalls, as guides to the solution of problems, as pointers to the way we need to go when we are floundering, as encouragement that we are right when we think we are wrong, and vice versa. The unconscious also communicates when we are awake. So-called idle thoughts provide us with insight into ourselves, into others, or into the world around us. For example, one of my patients, a young woman, had suffered since early adolescence from a sensation that she was about to topple over. So she walked with a straight-legged, wide-based gait. In the middle of our third session, a word popped into my mind, Pinocchio. I pushed it out, but the word came back again and again. Finally, I began to wonder, what the hell could Pinocchio mean? That she's Pinocchio? She's cute, a little doll. She walks like a stiff-legged wooden soldier. That's it. She's a puppet. Instantly, the essence of the patient was revealed. She was a puppet trying to act alive, but afraid that at any moment she would topple over and collapse in a tangle of sticks and strings. Formed by a domineering mother, her will was totally devoted to being clean, neat, and saying all the right things. She had a total lack of self-motivation and lacked ability to make autonomous decisions. This valuable insight presented itself as an unwelcome intruder. Its presence seemed alien and irrelevant, a quality characteristic of unconscious material as it appears to the conscious mind. Partly because of this alien quality and the associated resistance of the conscious mind, Freud perceived the unconscious as a repository of the primitive, the antisocial, and the evil within us. It is as if he assumed, because our consciousness did not want it, that unconscious material was bad. Similarly, he assumed that mental illness resided in the unconscious. I have concluded that mental illness is in fact a phenomenon of consciousness. Consider repression. Freud discovered in his patients sexual desires and hostile feelings of which they were not aware, yet which were clearly making them ill. But why were these desires and feelings located in the unconscious? Why were they repressed? Because the conscious mind did not want them. The problem is not that human beings have hostile and sexual feelings, but rather that human beings have a conscious mind that is often unwilling to bear the pain of dealing with these feelings. A third way in which the unconscious speaks to us is through our behavior, through slips of the tongue and other mistakes. The conscious mind is intent upon hiding the true self from the therapist and from self-awareness. But the unconscious struggles toward honesty, fighting to tell it like it is. Let me give an example. A touching slip of the tongue was made by a young woman on her initial visit. She presented herself as a confident woman of the world, who sought treatment because, she explained, "I am at loose ends for the moment, and I thought psychoanalysis might contribute to my intellectual development." Inquiring why she was at loose ends, I learned that she had just dropped out of college because she was 5 months pregnant. She did not want to get married. She vaguely thought she might put the baby up for adoption and proceed to Europe for further education. I asked if she had informed the baby's father of her pregnancy. "Yes," she said, "I did drop a note to let him know that our relationship was the product of a child." Meaning to say that a child was the product of their relationship, she had told me instead that underneath her mask of maturity was a child starved for affection, who had gotten pregnant to obtain mothering by becoming a mother. Our conscious self-concept almost always diverges to some degree from the person we actually are. But the unconscious is wiser than we are, wiser about everything. What is its source, this part of us that is wiser than we are? We do not know. The mind, which sometimes presumes to believe that there is no such thing as a miracle, is itself a miracle. Yet even if the wisdom of the unconscious were to be explained by the brain's intricate technology, we would still have no explanation for so-called psychic phenomena, which are clearly related to the operation of the unconscious. For instance, it is not uncommon for two individuals known to each other to have the same or incredibly similar dreams. I myself had a dream that consisted of a series of 7 images. I later learned that a friend, sleeping in my house 2 nights previously, had a dream in which the same 7 images occurred in the same sequence. The event was so implausible that it could not have occurred by accident. The incident qualifies as a genuine psychic or paranormal phenomenon, even though the meaning of the event is obscure. Probably the meaning of most paranormal phenomena is obscure. Yet many psychic phenomena seem to be fortunate, in some ways beneficial, to one or more of the people involved. A highly skeptical scientist, in analysis with me, recounted the following incident. After our last session, I drove home around the lake. As you know, the road has many blind curves. I was approaching perhaps the 10th curve when it occurred to me that a car could be racing around the corner far into my side of the road. I braked my car to a dead stop. No sooner had I done this than a car came barreling around the curve with its wheel 6 feet across the yellow line and barely missed me. Had I not stopped, we would have collided. I have no idea what made me stop. Are statistically improbable occurrences as likely to be harmful as they are beneficial? We hear of freak accidents as well as freak non-accidents. I can only state an unscientific impression that beneficial occurrences of this sort are more frequent than detrimental ones. The beneficial results need not be life-saving. More often they are simply life-enhancing. What we are talking of here is serendipity, defined as, quote, the gift of finding valuable or agreeable things not sought for, unquote. It is my thesis that grace, manifested in part by valuable or agreeable things not sought for, is available to everyone, but that some take advantage of it and others do not. Some time ago, I was working on the first section of this book in a colleague's library. His wife asked me about my book, and I told her that it concerned spiritual growth. I then sat down to work. Within half an hour, I had run into a snag. What I had written about responsibility clearly had to be enlarged, yet I felt this enlargement would detract from the flow of the work. I wrestled with this dilemma for an hour, getting nowhere. At this point, my colleague's wife arrived with a little book, How People Change, by Alan Wheelis. I thought you might be interested in this, she said. I thanked her and took it home with me. That very evening, something compelled me to put aside the other books I was consulting to read hers. One chapter expressed in depth what I would have tried to say about responsibility. So I condensed the section of my book to one paragraph, and in a footnote referred the reader to the Wheelis book. My dilemma was solved. This was not a stupendous event. Nonetheless, I was touched by grace. Similar events have always happened to me. Some I recognize, some I may take advantage of without being aware of their miraculous nature. I have no way of knowing how many I have let slip by. I have described a variety of phenomena that have characteristics in common. A. They serve to nurture life and spiritual growth. B. Their action is either incompletely understandable or totally obscure according to current scientific thinking. C. Their occurrence is commonplace and essentially universal. D. Their origin is outside of the conscious will and beyond conscious decision-making. I have therefore come to believe that these phenomena are manifestations of a single powerful force originating outside of human consciousness, which nurtures the spiritual growth of human beings. For thousands of years, this force has been recognized by the religious, who have applied to it the name of grace. We cannot touch or measure this force, yet it is real. Where does this force reside? Dreams suggest that grace resides in the unconscious mind. Synchronicity and serendipity indicate that the force exists outside the individual. Not only scientists have difficulty locating grace. The religious, who believe grace to be God's love, have through the ages had the same difficulty locating God. Immanence holds that grace emanates from an external God to men. Immanence holds that grace emerges from the God within the center of man's being. This problem arises from our desire to locate things. Human beings perceive the world as composed of entities, and we then tend to understand a phenomenon by saying it is such and such an entity. It is this or that, but it cannot be both. I try not to think of the individual as an entity. And insofar as I do, I conceive the boundaries of the individual as a permeable membrane, a fence through which other entities may climb, crawl, or flow. Just as our conscious mind is partially permeable to our unconscious, so is our unconscious permeable to the mind that lies without. Regardless of how we ascribe or locate them, miracles indicate that our growth is assisted by a force other than our conscious will. To further understand this force, consider yet another miracle, the growth process of life itself, evolution. Given what we understand of the universe, evolution should not occur. The second law of thermodynamics states that energy flows from a state of greater organization to a state of lesser organization. The universe is winding down. Ultimately, it will wind down into an undifferentiated blob. This state of total disorganization is termed entropy. The flow of evolution is against the force of entropy. Organisms have evolved from lower to higher and higher states of organization. I state that evolution is a miracle because as a process of increasing organization, it runs counter to natural law. In the ordinary course of things, you and I should not exist. Like biological evolution, the spiritual evolution of humanity is effortful and difficult. It is conducted against a natural inclination to keep things the way they were. The miracle is that this resistance is overcome. In significant numbers, humans manage to improve themselves and their cultures. There is a force that pushes us to transcend. What is this force that pushes us and our species to grow against our natural lethargy? It is love. Love is defined as the will to extend one's own or another's spiritual growth. When we grow, it is because we are working at it, and we are working at it because we love ourselves. It is through love that we elevate ourselves, and through our love for others that we help others elevate themselves. Love, the extension of the self, is evolution in progress. Among humanity, love is the miraculous force that defies the natural law of entropy. We are left with questions. Where does love come from? Whence comes the force of evolution? And whence comes grace, this force which nurtures the spiritual growth of human beings? To explain the miracles of grace and evolution, we hypothesize a God who wants us to grow, a God who loves us. To many, this hypothesis seems naive, but the simple notion of a loving God does not make for an easy philosophy. If we postulate that our capacity to love, grow, and evolve is somehow breathed into us by God, then we must ask, why does God want us to grow? What are we growing toward? Where is the goal of evolution? What does God want of us? No matter how we may pussyfoot around it, we eventually come to a single terrifying idea. God wants us to become God. We are growing toward godhood. God is the goal of evolution. No idea ever placed upon us such a burden. It is the most terrifying, most demanding idea in the history of mankind. It demands from us all we have, all that we can possibly give. The idea that God is actively nurturing us to be like Him brings us face to face with our own laziness. Ultimately, laziness is the only impediment to spiritual growth. If we overcome laziness, all other impediments will be overcome. If we do not overcome laziness, none of the others will be hurdled. Laziness is love's opposite. It is the force of entropy in our lives. In the struggle to help my patients grow, my chief enemy has invariably been their laziness. And I have become aware in myself of a reluctance to extend myself to new areas of responsibility. One thing I clearly have in common with all mankind is laziness. When I realized this, the serpent and the apple story suddenly made sense. The story indicates that God went walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and that there were open channels of communication between him and man. But then why did Adam and Eve not say to God, "Why don't you want us to eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil?" Instead, they broke God's law without understanding the reason behind the law. They listened to the serpent, but failed to get God's side of the story. Why was no step taken between temptation and action? The failure to take this step, the step of debate, is the essence of sin. The debate between the serpent and God is symbolic of the dialogue between good and evil in human beings. Our failure to conduct wholeheartedly this internal debate is the cause of those evil actions that constitute sin. In debating a course of action, human beings routinely fail to consult the God within them, the knowledge of rightness which resides within the minds of all mankind. We fail because we are lazy. It is work to hold these internal debates. And if we seriously listen to this God within us, we are usually urged to take the more difficult path. To conduct the debate is to open ourselves to suffering and struggle. Each of us, more or less frequently, we'll seek to avoid this painful step. A major form of laziness is fear. Fear of change. Fear that we might lose what we have if we venture forth. Fear of the work we will have to do. Adam and Eve were afraid of what might happen if they openly questioned God. Instead, they took the easy way to achieve knowledge not worked for. But they could not get away with it. To question God means a lot of work, but it must be done. Having suggested that laziness might be the devil, I think it is relevant to speak about the problem of evil. First, evil is real. It is not a figment of the primitive religious mind. There really are people and institutions who respond with hatred in the presence of goodness. They hate the light and will do anything to avoid or extinguish it. They hate the light because it reveals themselves to themselves. My second conclusion, then, is that evil is laziness carried to its extreme. Ordinary laziness is a passive failure to love. Truly evil people actively avoid extending themselves. If necessary, they will kill to escape the pain of spiritual growth. Ordinary laziness is non-love. Evil is anti-love. My third conclusion is that evil is inevitable at this stage in human evolution. Inevitably, laziness will be well controlled in some and completely uncontrolled in others. A few at one extreme will manifest pure love, a few at the other extreme, pure entropy or evil. And those at the extremes will be locked in combat, since evil naturally hates good and good evil. Last, I have concluded that human evil is strangely ineffective as a social force. For every soul it destroys, evil furthers the salvation of others. Most of us feel horror when we see evil in action, and take it as a signal to purify ourselves. It was evil that raised Christ to the cross, enabling us to see him from afar. Our personal involvement in the fight against evil is one of the ways we grow. We can now define spiritual growth as the growth or evolution of consciousness. But since the unconscious knows more than our consciousness knows, might we not conclude that to be conscious is to be in contact with both our conscious and unconscious mind? To become conscious is to bring the conscious mind into synchrony with the unconscious. But how can the unconscious possess all this knowledge which we have not consciously learned? Here again, I know of no hypothesis as satisfactory as the postulation of a God who is a part of us. If you want to look for grace, look within yourself. If you desire wisdom, find it inside you. The interface between God and man is at least in part the interface between our unconscious and our conscious minds. To put it plainly, our unconscious is God, God within us. God has been with us all along, is now, and always will be. I have said that the goal of spiritual growth is for the individual to become as one with God. Since the unconscious is God, we may further define the goal to be the attainment of Godhood by the conscious self. Does this mean that the conscious merges with the unconscious? No. The point is to become God while preserving consciousness. We are born that we might become, as conscious individuals, a new life form of God. The goal is to develop a mature, conscious ego, which can then be the ego of God. If as adults we can identify our mature free will with that of God, then we will be agents of God's grace, creating love where love did not exist, pulling our fellow beings up to our own level of awareness, pushing evolution forward. We can now understand power, a much misunderstood subject. There are two kinds of power, political and spiritual. Political power is the capacity to coerce others. It resides in a position, such as a kingship or presidency, or in money. It does not reside in the person who occupies the position or possesses the money. Political power is unrelated to goodness or wisdom. Stupid and evil people have walked as kings upon the earth. Spiritual power, however, resides within the individual and has nothing to do with coercion. People of spiritual power may be wealthy and may occupy positions of leadership, but they are as likely to be poor and lacking in political authority. Spiritual power is the capacity to make decisions with maximum awareness. It is consciousness. The experience of spiritual power is joyful. Joy comes with mastery, with really knowing what we are doing. And there is a greater joy, the joy of communion with God. For when we truly know what we are doing, we are participating in the omniscience of God. Our conscious self has come into alignment with the mind of God. We know with God. Yet those who have attained such awareness are invariably humble. When asked the source of their knowledge and power, the truly powerful reply, "I am merely a conduit. What power I have is a minute expression of a far greater power." And this humility is joyful, Because aware of their closeness to God, the truly powerful transcend their sense of self. Such transcendence brings with it a calm ecstasy, not unlike the experience of being in love. Aware of their intimate connectedness to God, they experience a surcease of loneliness. There is communion. Joyful though it is, the experience of spiritual power is also terrifying. The closer one comes to Godhood, the more one feels sympathy with God. To participate in God's omniscience is also to share His agony. There is another problem with power, aloneness. Here there is a similarity between spiritual and political power. There is no one to blame, no one to tell you how, no one on the same level to share the agony or the responsibility. You alone are responsible. This kind of aloneness could not be borne, were it not that as we outdistance our fellow humans, our relationship to God becomes closer. The joy of this communion sustains us. Let us now examine mental illness in the light of what has been said about grace. We live in a real world. To live well, we must understand the reality of the world. But such understanding comes only through effort and suffering. All of us, to some extent, avoid this effort and suffering. If in our laziness and fear we massively defend our awareness, then our understanding of the world will bear little relation to reality. Because actions are based on understanding, our behavior will then become unrealistic. When this occurs to a sufficient degree, others will deem us mentally ill. But long before this, we are served notice of our maladjustment through bad dreams, anxiety attacks, depressions, and other symptoms. The painful symptoms of mental illness are manifestations of grace. They notify people that their spirits are not growing and are in jeopardy. Most reject this gift of grace by avoiding responsibility for their illness. They ignore their symptoms. Only those few who realize that their symptoms indicate a disorder in the soul will heed the unconscious and accept its grace. They accept the pain of the work necessary to heal themselves, and they gain great reward. It was of them that Christ said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." The relationship between grace and mental illness is beautifully embodied in the Greek myth of Orestes. Orestes was a grandson of Atreus, who had attempted to prove himself more powerful than the gods. Because of this crime, the gods cursed his descendants. When Orestes' mother, compelled by the curse, murdered her husband, his father, the Greek code of honor obliged Orestes to slay his father's murderer. Yet the greatest sin a Greek could commit was matricide. Orestes agonized, but finally killed his mother. For this sin, the gods visited upon him the Furies, three ghastly harpies who could be seen and heard only by him, and who tormented him night and day with their cackling criticism and frightening appearance. After many years of lonely atonement, Orestes asked the gods to lift his curse. The gods held a trial. Speaking in Orestes' defense, Apollo argued that he had left Orestes with no choice but to kill his mother, and that therefore Orestes really could not be held responsible. Orestes contradicted his defender. "It was I, not Apollo, that murdered my mother." Amazed at this assumption of total responsibility by a mere mortal, the gods decided in Orestes' favor. They transformed the Furies into the Eumenides, loving spirits whose wise counsel brought Orestes good fortune. The Eumenides are referred to as, quote, the bearers of grace, unquote. The hallucinatory Furies, who could be perceived only by Orestes, represent symptoms of mental illness. The transformation of Furies into Eumenides occurred because Orestes accepted responsibility for his illness. He did not see himself as a victim of society, ancestors, or fate. Instead, he accepted his condition as one of his own making and undertook to heal it. Through this healing process, the very things that had caused him agony became the things that brought him wisdom. Orestes did not go to a psychotherapist. He healed himself. And even had there been psychiatrists in ancient Greece, he still would have had to heal himself. With or without psychotherapy, people heal themselves. Then why is it so few do, and so many do not? Why do so few choose to travel the path of spiritual growth? Most psychotherapists believe that some people are sicker than others, and therefore more difficult to heal. This is true, yet it fails to take into account the will to grow. The will to grow is in essence the same as love, the will to extend oneself for spiritual growth. Loving people are growing people. Because of grace, it is possible for people to transcend loveless parenting and become loving individuals who evolve far beyond their parents. Why then do only some people spiritually evolve? Why do so few heed the call? Why this powerful resistance to health? The answer is laziness, the original sin of entropy. The call to grace is a call to a life of service and sacrifice, a call to be a parent to mankind. So it is no wonder that patients in psychotherapy have little taste for the power that accompanies mental health. But for most people, the fear of responsibility is the central issue in their resistance to grace. To rise to a position of such power that we have no one to blame but ourselves is a fearful state of affairs. Many refuse to acknowledge the God within themselves because they are afraid of being the sole master of their ship. Most people want peace without the aloneness of power, and the self-confidence of adulthood without having to grow up. So the question is not why people resist grace. The question is rather, how is it that a few do heed the call, and what distinguishes the few from the many? I am unable to answer this question. When all is said and done, grace remains a mystery. We are left facing a paradox. In saying that few choose to heed the call of grace because of the difficulties involved, I have implied that obtaining grace is a matter of our choice. I know this to be true. Yet I also know that we do not come to grace. Grace comes to us. The common experience of those who have achieved grace is amazement. Perhaps the best we can say is that while we cannot will ourselves to grace, we can, by will, prepare ourselves to be fertile ground. If we can become disciplined, loving individuals, we will have prepared well for the coming of grace. The paradox that we both choose and are chosen by grace is the essence of serendipity, the gift of finding valuable or agreeable things not sought for. Buddha found enlightenment only when he stopped seeking and let it come to him. On the other hand, who can doubt that enlightenment came precisely because he had devoted 16 years to seeking it? The same approach should be employed toward love. If we want to be loved, we must first make ourselves lovable. When we nurture ourselves and others without concern for finding reward, then the reward will find us. So it is with human love and with God's love. Let us redefine serendipity not as a gift, but as a learned capacity to recognize and use the gifts of grace. With this capacity, our journey of spiritual growth is guided by the unimaginable wisdom of God. So guided, the journey becomes ever faster. But do not ask proof that every step of the way will be safe. Spiritual travelers must carve out with effort and anxiety their own paths toward God. On this journey, we often become discouraged. The fact that we live in a scientific age, while helpful in some respects, has caused us to suffer a sense of personal meaninglessness. Yet, once we perceive the reality of grace, the image of ourselves as meaningless and insignificant is shattered. The fact that a powerful force beyond ourselves nurtures our growth and evolution indicates with certainty that human spiritual growth is of utmost importance to something greater than ourselves. This something we call God. The existence of grace is prima facie evidence of the reality of a loving God. We are not lost in the universe. The reality of grace indicates humanity to be at the center of the universe, at the center of God's vision. This time and space exist for us to travel through. The human race is making an evolutionary leap. Whether or not we succeed in that leap is your personal responsibility and mine. This universe has been laid down as a stepping stone toward the kingdom of God. We must step across it one by one. Through grace we are helped not to stumble, and through grace we know we are being welcomed. What more can we ask?
This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.